And Fevzi Turkalp joins us now. Morning, Fevzi.
Morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. So, actually, can I ask you first of all, we were just talking before the news to somebody about online gaming in China and this three-hour rule. What are your thoughts on that?
So, well, I mean, as you'll know, so the government has now further restricted under-18s online gaming to 3 hours a week. And it's very prescriptive, 8 to 9pm on a Friday, on a Saturday and on a Sunday night. I mean, it's all obviously something that can only be done in an authoritarian state. I think governments in this country and in the West would have trouble following suit, although I guess some of them may have similar concerns. I mean, the underlying concern is that online gaming is highly addictive. It's designed from the get-go to be highly addictive. And, you know, like most addictive behaviours, can be destructive to family life and even harming the economy. So, you know, China's got, I guess, legitimate concerns. It's just that the way they're going about it is rather...
Mm. How do they do it? I mean, is it technically possible to... I don't know, maybe if you're China, you can just switch off everybody's games. How can you do it?
Well, so they're putting a lot of pressure on the companies that make these games. And bear in mind, for example, these are online games, so you have to be connected.
Right.
One of the major providers of online games has introduced facial recognition technology to get around people sort of logging on as a parent or an adult and trying to get around it that way.
Oh.
So there'll be a camera staring you in the face, recognizing you. I mean, obviously it has, you know, quite gross implications in terms of one's privacy and civil liberties. But I guess in China, that's the least of your problems at this point.
Yeah, I mean, we have an issue in the West as well. I know as a parent of teenagers, it was absolute hell when they wanted to play games and you say, okay, just 10 minutes more, and then they don't want to come off because the games are designed to be as addictive as possible, and there is never a good moment to stop.
No,
and I remember just pulling the plug out of the wall sometimes because it's so frustrating.
And I think that's where, you know, world governments could bring their focus to bear, not necessarily on trying to control the number of hours that people play when the games are highly addictive, but look at why they are highly addictive and maybe try to deal with that aspect. In particular, the way in which games have moved away from either being free or being a fixed cost of, you know, you'd pay a tenner or £20 or £30 or £40, whatever it was a fixed cost and then the game was yours, through now all this sort of pay to play and even pay to win, where they use... They literally employ psychologists to work out at which point during the gameplay you are most vulnerable to the suggestion that you should part with some money to buy something that you need to further your progress through that particular game. And, you know, most things that are designed to be addictive are controlled. And I think that, you know, they need to maybe look at that aspect and also how they're built for. So a game should not... You hear these stories, you know, with more frequency than I would like. But, you know, you hear about people having spent thousands and even tens of thousands of pounds on a game. And that's just not right. What you should have is that, you know, it should be an upfront cost. You should know what it is, or at least a subscription, but not something where it's like a drug dealer handing out free drugs at the school gate. They give away the games in quotes free, get people addicted to them, and then get them to shell out money that often isn't theirs.
Yeah, and I wonder as well whether, I mean, this is probably bad news for your job, but aren't we addicted to all of this technology too much anyway?
Well, we are, and there were some interesting interviews with some of the original designers of the Android operating system, and I think iOS as well, where the some of the early designers were interviewed and actually said that they were told to make the games as addictive as possible, and they had input into how to do that. And notifications, you know, not just within games or, you know, apps, but notifications on your smartphones are a good example of that sort of rush. And also, you know, likes in social media and so forth. These things are designed to take advantage of weaknesses in our psychological makeup. And it's like your enemy has analyzed you and then used what they've learned against you. And that's just not the way we should be doing things.
No, well, if you've just tuned in, Fevzi Turkalp is with me and we're talking about technology. Fevzi's going to hang around with us for a little while. So if you've got a question, you want some advice, this is your chance. And don't worry if it's a really simple question. It might be about what to buy, how to get something working, how to get the most out of a gadget. Then do call us or text or tweet. And we tend to find, well, it's always nice to have calls. But equally, when we talk tech, we often get more messages than phone calls. So we'll see what happens this morning, I'm not sure. But if you want to text, it's 84850 if you have a tech question of any kind. If you want to tweet, it's at LBC. And if you want to call, which is ideal, but it's not always convenient, I know, at 2:15 in the morning. But if you want to call with a question for Fevzi, then it's 0345 6060973. And a couple of things we are definitely going to be talking about are wearables and fitness tech as well. So I'd like to hear your experiences of that. And Bitcoin, people are going mad about Bitcoin at the moment. We're not going to give financial advice about that, obviously. But I do want to talk to Fevzi about how that all works. So if you have a question about mobile phones, about computers, laptops, televisions, games, whatever the question. I was going to say for a minute, hi-fis, and it was debating recently. One of our younger members of the team here on the production team, the subject of what hi-fis came up, not Wi-Fi, hi-fi, and they said, well, what's a hi-fi? And actually thinking about it, not many people have got a hi-fi now, have they?
No, it's kind of when the iPod came out that the emphasis moved away from quality, which is, you know, what hi-fi nuts, you know, audio nuts were you know, keen on in the 70s and 80s and so forth. And then when the iPod came along, it was not about the quality of the music. It was how many of your songs or how many songs can you fit into this thing that's, you know, fit in your shirt pocket.
Yeah.
And it became all about capacity and number of songs. And even, and that was sort of aided by the internet, which in the beginning was slow, and particularly even now where you're dealing with streaming services, there are very few niche providers of really high quality audio via the internet. I mean, you can find it. There's ones for, you know, classical music and well, you know, audio nuts, but for the most part, we're willing to accept music which is not that much better than cassette tape. You know, when you talk about MP3 files, some of them are not that good, you know. And
what about the sound quality? I remember people used to have in their living rooms gigantic loudspeakers that were the size of a fridge, and they did sound brilliant, and they were sort of boomy and bassy and all of that, but they were a piece of furniture. I mean, they really intruded. Now you buy little speakers, and they do sound pretty good.
Yes.
But are they comparable, or have we lost our ability to hear really good sound?
So this is quite interesting because it gets into a new area called computational audio. So if you look at, say, an Apple smart speaker, it sounds much better than a speaker of that size has any right to sound. It doesn't necessarily sound as good.
I heard one recently and I thought, wow, this is a little tiny one called a mini, HomePod mini, and it's the size of an Apple.
It's about 3.5 inches across, isn't it?
So, incredible. And the bass, I mean, how do they do it?
Yeah, so with computational audio, what they do is they don't just pump out sound and good luck with that, wherever it happens to bounce off and so forth. These devices have a number of microphones in them, and they detect the sound coming back, and they analyze the sound in real time, and they calculate what that sound might be. So if it's too close to the wall and you're getting too much reverberation, too much booming bass, it can adapt itself to the position in the room and the general acoustics of the room, what the surfaces are like and so forth. So they do the same thing with photography, by the way. If you look at Apple and others now, when it takes a photo, the processors in a smartphone are so powerful that they can actually look at every dot in the picture and adjust it for high dynamic range and everything. So what you see is not what you get, and what you hear is not what you get anymore. You can now adjust these things using very powerful processors in real time. And the effect is that you can get pretty good sound. That said, you know, a 1980s hi-fi, which was decent in the day with separates and its own amplifier, and speakers and proper stands and all the rest of it. I mean, those things can still sound great, and there are ways of making them viable again, because, you know, you'll normally have an auxiliary input on an old amplifier. You could, for example, plug in a Bluetooth adapter to it, and suddenly your 30, 40-year-old hi-fi has learned Bluetooth, and you can stream to it from your smartphone or tablet or other devices. And that sort of thing, I think, is a good way forward. I'm all in favour, much as I love my gadgets, I'm all in favour of encouraging people to give their existing tech a new lease of life. And sometimes it will be better. I mean, a 1980s hi-fi will still sound better than the best that Apple has got to offer in terms of its smart speakers. If it was a good one, you know, back in the day, then it will still be good.
Well, Fevzi Turkalp's with us if you've got a question, and I can see a number of people have, and we're talking about technology at the moment. Fevzi Turkalp is with me to tackle your questions, and we've got a question for you, Fevzi, from Sue in Eastbourne. Hello, Sue.
Oh, hello there. Right, hello, Fevzi.
Hi, Sue.
I've got a MacBook Air, and it belonged to my husband, and he passed away last year. Right, so I've taken it back to, I thought I'd taken it back to factory settings, but when I've come to it, his name still appears, and I don't know how to clean it completely. Is it possible?
Yeah. So, Sue, is there nothing on the computer that you wish to recover? Are there no documents or photographs?
No. We decided, I want to actually give it to my daughter, and I wanted to sort of clean it off for her. But there's nothing on there that we need to save.
Okay. And are you able to log in as your husband's user account?
Yes, I do. I set it up for him. So.
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, it depends on exactly which version of the Mac operating system that you're running. But in principle, it's actually quite straightforward with an Apple Mac. As long as you've got an active internet connection on it, it's possible to boot it up in a particular way that allows you to go into what's called recovery mode. And when you're in recovery mode, one of the options you've got is to just completely wipe it. And what it will do is it will download the latest version of the operating system over the internet. So it might take an hour or two. It will download it and install it, and it will make everything as new. And that's probably the best thing to do. How old is the laptop, if you don't mind me asking?
I think it's probably 2 or 3 years old now.
Okay, so not too bad. Well, it should still run, excuse me, Big Sur, which is the silly name.
Oh, I couldn't get that on. Yes, I tried to load that on today, and it wouldn't do it. It said that an error's come up. Hmm.
Okay, did it say what sort of error, Sue?
Oh, I'm afraid I can't remember.
Okay. Well, it's worth checking. Maybe if it's a little bit older than we think, then it may not be compatible. In any event, it will allow you to download the latest compatible version. And, you know, that's what I would do. But it varies a little bit depending on which machine you've got. So you can either go online and look that up, or you can speak to AppleCare, even if it is out of warranty and so forth. If you put a phone call through to them on their 0800 number, they will actually help you with the reset instructions for your particular machine. But the principle of what will happen is it will not only wipe everything out, but it will put the most recent version of the operating system that particular machine is capable of running, and it will give you a completely fresh machine. And a fresh start for that machine.
And they're very good. If you ring them up, they will talk you through it whilst you're doing it. And is this the thing? I think I did this recently for someone where you restart the laptop, but you're holding a couple of keys down at the same time.
Yeah.
So it opens up in a particular mode.
Yes, and which keys you hold depends somewhat on how old the machine is and what version.
Right. Does that ring a bell, Sue?
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay, good, good. Good luck with it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
The only other thing I'd say to Sue is, although Apple are much better at support than many companies in that they won't look at when you bought it and say, we won't help you. They will genuinely do their best. One of the things that I have noticed with Apple, as they have grown in popularity, is that some of the caliber of some of their technicians is not what it was. Doesn't mean they're not trying to help you. They try and be very helpful, but some of them seem to be working from fairly basic scripts. And I've certainly had misinformation from Apple techs. If Sue or anyone else needs to contact Apple and they get to the point where they don't think they're getting anywhere, or they doubt the veracity of some of the information they're being given, even, they have the right to ask for a second or even third tier technician. So you ask them to pass it up the line, and they're usually very good about it. They don't normally get defensive about doing that. And it might mean they need to call you back. But, I mean, I've had it where, you know, frankly, they've given me bad information. So I mean, it can happen to anyone. It just never used to happen with Apple, and now it happens with them as well. But don't be shy about asking them to escalate the problem if you're not happy, you know, because otherwise they kind of have a document for everything, which is great. And at the end of a call, they'll send you like three or four different documents about the things that you've discussed. And it kind of leads you to work your way through it. But sometimes the advice isn't what it used to be. And that's a bit of a worry, to be honest with you. But as long as you're aware of that and, you know, not shy of asking them to escalate it, then they're still an excellent company for their support.
Okay, Sue, good luck with that. On the subject of fitness gear, which we're going to talk about, I've got a question here from Lee in Hull, who says, since developing heart problems, a paramedic recommended to me a Garmin Vivo Smart 4 smartwatch to keep a 24-hour check on my heart rate. It's awesome, and it certainly reassures me.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with these?
Yeah, so there's quite a few that do similar things. So one of the challenges with 24-hour monitoring is that when you're monitoring the heart, it increases the draw on the battery. And, you know, unlike conventional watches where you put a battery in and it lasts you a few years and you go to a jeweler's and change it, with most but not all smartwatches, you have to charge them every 24-hour period, which is not ideal. So it's a more recent development where they've been able to do 24-hour monitoring. The Vivo Smart from Garmin does it. The Withings Scan Watch does it. Even the Apple Watch can do it, although it tends to struggle a bit with the battery life. It's sometimes worth, if you want to do 24-hour monitoring, it's sometimes worth going for what's called a hybrid smartwatch. And that's one with, yes, it's got the smarts in it and it's got a little screen, but the majority of the watch face is a conventional-looking watch face. And the benefit of those is, so the Scan Watch is a hybrid watch face, the one from Withings. And the benefit of that is instead of getting 24 hours, you might get 3 weeks out of it before you need to charge it again. And the reason why that's important is because some of the stuff that you're monitoring will be going on when you're sleeping. And if you have to wear it during the day and during the night, then when are you going to charge it if you have to charge it every 24-hour period? But yeah, it's an interesting thing because these devices can quite literally be lifesavers, but they have to be carefully introduced so that we don't generate a whole generation of worried well and loads of scans going off to NHS doctors who can't cope with them. So, you know, we kind of have to build up the infrastructure around the wearable devices as well as the technology in the wearable device itself.
Good point here from Nick in Folkestone, just reminding us that an easy way to get the info for that lady's Mac is YouTube. It takes about 5 minutes. And that is true that a lot of these tasks now, you just do a little Google or a YouTube search, and somebody, some kind person like yourself, Fevzi, is there saying, oh, this is how you reboot your Mac.
Yeah, and the thing is, when it's something important like this, I think it's worth, notwithstanding my earlier comments about sometimes Apple not giving the best advice, that they are more solid resource than YouTube. YouTube has got some excellent stuff on there, but it's got some not so excellent stuff on there, and the difficulty is telling between the two. And you know, that this is not particularly critical in that, you know, it's not dangerous because you're not trying to preserve the data on it. But I would be very careful. And also YouTube, watching YouTube videos, again, it's very addictive. I spend a lot of time, on YouTube. But it's not the most efficient way, you know, because the search results are videos that are anything from, 5 to 45 minutes long. You know, some people kind of beat about the bush a little bit. And you find that, you spent an hour and you still haven't got the answer. If you are going to do a search, then a simple, Google type search can give you better results, because also it gives you a written list of steps to go through. Whereas if you're working off a video, keep having to pause the video and skip back a bit and then pause again and do that bit. It's not always easy to do that. So although it's a useful resource, I wouldn't rely upon it solely. I still think, where you've got the option of going to Apple, you're lucky, because for the most part, if you had a Dell computer, I wouldn't recommend you spend your time trying to get help from Dell, frankly. I mean, there's a reason why Apple charge more for the machines that they sell, and one of the reasons, other than a very healthy profit margin, is the fact that some of that goes into something approaching a decent level of support.
Yeah, which absolutely. Which a lot of companies won't do at all.
No, some products you buy, it's a few years old. They kiss it goodbye.
I mean,
it used to be, Apple support used to be legendary. You used to have all these examples of people walking in with machines that were well outside warranty, where they had dropped them, and as long as they were honest about it, the Apple bar geniuses, as they term themselves, had the capacity to swap it out for a new or a reconditioned unit, even though they were not obliged to do that. They're not as generous these days, but they're still in an industry that's become progressively less generous. They're still at the more generous end in terms of the support that they give and what they're willing to do. If you play fair with them and you're honest with them, because if you tell them, oh, I don't know what's gone wrong with it, and they open it and all the moisture seals show that the thing's been submerged,
dropped it in the bath.
They're not going to be best pleased with you. But if you're straight with them, they normally try and help you.
Fair enough. Fevzi Turkalp is here. Here's a few comments coming in. Declan says, this is uncanny. I'm so sick of Apple Music. 2 hours ago, I ordered an 80s-style hi-fi system, complete with tape deck and speakers. I also have a cassette player in my car. It sounds brilliant. He says, I also heard that the last project Steve Jobs was working on was trying to capture all the frequencies of vinyl to stream, but the file sizes were too big.
Well, yeah, because it's quite interesting. I mean, one of the reasons why people like vinyl, other than sort of retro chic and so forth, is that it's not as limited. There are frequencies that you don't hear, overtones and undertones, that although you don't hear them directly, modify that which you do hear. Yeah, it modulates the waves that you can hear. And when you've got CD, even CD quality, you've got 44,100 little samples a second, but even that is not sufficient to capture everything. But then it's a balance, you see, because you can have a really high bit rate and a bit depth and all this sort of thing, but if your speakers are no good, if your amplifier is no good, it doesn't get you very far. I mean, look at what's happened with modern television. So we had the old-fashioned TVs that were, as deep as they were wide. Yeah, they were like cube-shaped boxes.
Yeah, and
one
heavy.
Of the things that, yeah, but and they were, lots and lots of disadvantages, but there was space in them for decent speakers. Now, if you look at flat screen TVs, they're getting flatter and thinner to the point where you can hang them on the wall as if they were a picture, literally millimeters thick. Of course, physics is what it is. You can't get a really good speaker into something of that depth. And that means that even when you've spent, £8,000 on a, 8K television set with an OLED screen and all the rest of it, the speakers are still going to be poor. And therefore, then the answer to that is you have to have external speakers. Now, you can get a sound bar, which is a sort of bar of speakers that sits underneath the TV, has at least three speakers in it, one central speaker for speech, and then left and right speakers built in for stereo separation. Or you can get surround sound, 5.1 surround with five speakers and a bass subwoofer in the corner. You can do all of those things, but what's built into the TV is now, not very good, even when you spend a lot of money for it, because there isn't space.
Absolutely. Let's take another call. It's David in Esher. Hello, David.
Hi there.
Hi, David. What were you calling about?
It's when you get a scam phone call, and you can usually tell when they're scams, I get rid of them very quickly nowadays, but they do try and get you to go through and dial one.
When they say push button one. Yeah.
Now, is that as dangerous as people say it is? Can they get your details and various things and get into all sorts of things? And if it is, why don't BT and the various phone providers do something about it and stop it?
Okay, so one of the reasons why they get you to push a number, which may be one or it may be another number or combination numbers, is often, excuse me, these calls are made by automated systems. They're made by computers that often don't have your number, but are literally going through every number, one, you know, incrementing the number by one and just dialing it. And they want to know if there's a human being at the other end. If you respond by pressing one, you're signaling to the machine that they've hit the jackpot. That's a real phone number, and there's someone on the other end. What the machine then does?
They've established that when they first phoned you.
Well, it depends, and it depends on the type of call, because a lot of the calls are automated calls, and what they will do, David, is they will, when they've established a human being has answered, they will then route your call to one of their human beings so that they can actually get far more of these calls out there than they would if the humans were dialing out themselves, you know. So there might be, the machine might make 1,000 calls before it hits upon not only a real number, but a real number with a person on the end of it who's willing to play ball by pushing the button that they're asked to. All of this tells them there's a human there, and that human may be suggestible, you know, because they've already done what you've asked them to, which is to press one. It's a great shame. These scams take many forms. I would just say that the thing that's probably common to most of them is that they all try to introduce a sense of urgency for you to take certain actions that maybe you wouldn't take if you were able to take time and think about it and talk to people. So they'll either tell you things like, you know, all your money's about to be stolen and we need to move it out of the way, or they'll tell you that you've won a great amount of money, but you have to move quickly because you'll lose the opportunity. If they are trying to instill a sense of urgency in you, that's often a good sign. And obviously, you know, I say obviously, but you know, if people want access to your computer system, do not give it to them. Do not download programs at their behest. Do not read codes off your screen that will enable them to gain access to your computer. Because once you've done that, you've given them the keys to the kingdom. They've got access to your email account. They can reset the various passwords in your banking, online shopping, credit cards, loans, mortgages, all sorts of things are then potentially affected. So it's not at that point, if they've got access, say, to your computer, it's not just a matter of, you know, cleaning up the computer. You're going to have to start freezing accounts and getting cards reissued and that sort of thing. Although, you know, it's interesting what you said at the beginning, David, you said, you know, you can normally tell. A lot of the scam calls are really obvious, but some of them are very sophisticated. And sometimes they just get lucky because they'll claim to be from a particular bank or a particular courier. And it will just so happen that, you know, a percentage of the population will bank with that particular bank or be waiting for a package which may or may not be from that courier. And it gives them a sense of believability, you know, because even though 95 out of 100 people might not find it believable because it doesn't connect with them, for the ones that it does, where they've been lucky, you know, it becomes a lot more plausible. The other thing that they do, and I guess that people should be careful of, is where phone numbers are spoofed. That's to say that the phone number that is calling you or texting you may not be the real one that it appears to be from. And why that's important is, let's say I've had dealings with HMRC by text message, for example, and I have a thread of text messages which I know to be legitimate from HMRC. Then another text message pops up in the same thread purporting to be from HMRC, and it looks genuine, and I believe it's genuine because it's in the same thread and it appears to have come from the same number. But the reality is, or maybe, that they've spoofed it, they've faked it, they've made their text message appear to come from that number, even when it hasn't. Interestingly enough, one of the benefits of the 5G network is it will make spoofing of numbers much more difficult. I hesitate to say impossible because nothing's impossible, but you know, we hear a lot of bad and worrying things about 5G. Most of it is made up, but one of the really good things about 5G is that it should provide us with a bit more security.
Okay, David, interesting question. Funnily enough, we're going to be talking about fraud with a fraud expert in the next hour as well. Here's a question from Don, who says, my neighbour keeps using my Bluetooth to play things through my TV. I've asked him to stop, but it seems to encourage him. How can I stop this happening? It's caused some discomfort because he starts playing Right Said Fred in my room at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my God. Deeply dippy. Oh, my God. Well, you know, let's hope for all sorts of good reasons that you don't test positive for COVID, because then you may be done for being too close to you, albeit on the wrong side of a wall. This is kind of difficult because Bluetooth is not a secure network, and it's not really easy to push people off it. All I can suggest to you is that when you're not using your Bluetooth, the Bluetooth on your device, is to switch it off.
Seriously? When you see... But surely they have to be paired up, don't they? So your neighbour can't play straight onto your TV.
Not all devices require pairing.
Really?
Well, they do require pairing, but not all of them require codes.
Right.
Yeah, because some devices like headphones and so forth, you know, it's not always possible to do it. So, yeah, I mean, it can be problematic. You also get that with, not just with Bluetooth, but also with Wi-Fi. If you haven't secured your Wi-Fi, people send documents to your printer.
I've had that, yeah, and I don't think it was not malicious. It wasn't even in the same building. Weirdly, it was the next door neighbour, and I just got a random couple of sheets of A4 coming out of my printer, and I think I've stopped that happening now because it is possible with Wi-Fi, isn't it?
Yeah, And the interesting thing about Bluetooth, Clive, is that as with each new generation of Bluetooth, and we're up to sort of 5 now, you know, the range improves. So this sort of problem can be more of an issue. You know, I mean, the best thing to do is just switch it off, or you can sometimes rename the device so that it's not obvious that it's yours. It's not always possible. I mean, there's quite a lot of variation in what's possible on Bluetooth devices, but certainly in some cases, you know, no codes are required and pairing can be done, and it's annoying. I would just say to you that just as he has access to your Bluetooth devices, you may have access to his.
Yes.
I'm not suggesting it, but, you know, it's a double-edged sword, that.
Yeah, frankly. You could blast it back at 5 a.m. instead. Chris says, fascinated by your guest on TVs, I'm deeply unhappy with modern televisions. I suffer headaches and eye trouble with these TVs. The sound is barely audible. I much preferred my Sony Trinitron Dolby Surround TV of 20 years ago. Yeah. I think the sound was better on older TVs.
Well, it was, but I would just look at it like this. You know, when we were talking about hi-fi, and we used to talk about separates, didn't we? So there was a separate amplifier and speakers and CD player and cassette deck and what, mini disc player, all the different components, and you'd wire them all together. You should maybe view your television as a component in a separate setup and ignore the fact that there are speakers built into it, because they're not very good. They're probably just enough to let you know the thing's working before you connect it up, but then connect it to an external speaker system. You know, if you're going to spend a fair amount of money on a large screen TV, budget some of that to go to the sound, because the sound is funny, because, you know, when you go from, say, HD, which is 1,080 lines, to 4K, which is 4 times the resolution of a full HD screen, you don't get 4 times the enjoyment out of it. You know, it's marginal, and some people, frankly, can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
You know,
And the sound is not 4 times as good, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, but the point is, if instead you put some of that budget into a 5.1 surround system, and suddenly you've got spaceships whizzing over your head and gunfire all around you, and people's sat voices seem to be coming from which part of the screen that they're on, you know, then the increase in enjoyment of the film or whatever it is, the sports, whatever it is you're watching, is so much greater. The increase
that
in
is true.
Greater. Absolutely. So I think it's often overlooked. We think of televisions as being visual, but they're audio visual, and we should not ignore the
audio. Don't underestimate the sound. Right now we're talking tech with Fevzi Turkalp, and I wanted to ask you, Fevzi, I've got another question in from a listener who wanted to know about Bitcoin and whether it's possible to explain in layman's terms how that works. Not the financial advice side of it, but I don't get it, to be honest. What is it?
Okay, so a Bitcoin is an example of what's called a cryptocurrency, which is a form of digital money. Pounds can be digital as well. You know, the way the pounds are conveyed between banks is not through physical form, but unlike pounds and euros and so forth, Bitcoin does not have any physical form. There are no, ironically, there are no Bitcoins and there are no Bitcoin notes either. There's no physical form of it. All that there is a series of nodes across the internet where these things are traded. Another difference is, unlike a conventional currency, there is no issuing central bank. So in this country, we have the Bank of England that issues it and is in control of the money supply. And it's often part of the government's economic policies and levers in its control, where it can print more money. Quantitative easing, I think was the term they used to use about that, can print lots of money to get out of it. But when you do that, the difficulty is that there's then more money, you tend to devalue the money. In bitcoins, there will never be more than, I think, 21 million bitcoins in the world. And therefore, it has an independence from those banks. But one of the problems with it, therefore, is that there's no organization behind it which is in control of it that can tend to stabilize a run on a currency. And because of that, what you often see with cryptocurrencies, including but not only limited to Bitcoin, is a lot of fluctuation. You know, so a Bitcoin, I think when it started, a Bitcoin was worth $1. And then it was worth $30,000, and then it was worth $3, you know, and I think it's current, I'm not sure what it is at the moment, about $8,000. So, you know, you've got these differences. So no physical form, no bank. You can trade them electronically with pounds, so you can swap pounds for bitcoins and bitcoins for pounds or euros or anything like that. So in that sense, it's like a normal currency, but it has... If you were an investor, you might want to put some of your money in it as a high-risk thing. And I'm certainly, as you said, I'm not giving any financial investment advice, but some people invest in them. But, it is a lot more variable.
Why do they say that it's bad for the environment, that it's using up all this computer time or energy?
Well, the way that these electronic bitcoins are created is through a process known as Bitcoin mining. And this is where you get very powerful computers, often with the same circuitry in them as for high-end gaming computers. The gaming cards, the graphics cards, are used to run processes, algorithms that are used to create bitcoins. Yeah? You mine, it's like digging, but instead of digging, you're using a computer. But the problem is, it's a very computationally expensive thing to do. So the computers are expensive. The electricity that they use is extremely expensive because these things run the whole farms of these devices, you know, whole, you know, big areas of many, many devices linked together.
What are they actually doing? I mean, they're not making a coin, are they?
They're not making a coin. They're doing sums.
Really?
Yeah, they're doing
sums. They're doing sums, and that makes it valuable.
Yeah. So when bitcoins were invented, they were invented with algorithms that were there to create them and add to something called blockchain. So you've got this thing called a blockchain, which is, because there's no central bank, there's no single easy record of all the transactions that have taken place. And you need to have something like that to stop someone, for example, spending the same Bitcoin twice. So you need to have this thing called blockchains. And then what you're doing through this computational thing is you're adding blocks to the blockchain, and it's computationally very intensive. And the reason why, therefore, it's said to be bad for the environment is because these computers are drawing huge amounts of electricity.
And are they doing these sums just for the sake of it?
No, these sums are what are required to generate new Bitcoins. So you're creating.
They're not effectively. But how are they required? I mean, has somebody just made this up? Okay, we've got to do lots of sums, and if we do lots of sums, then that counts as a Bitcoin. Is that basically it?
Yes. So the idea for Bitcoin was first, I think it was floated in 2008, and the author went under a pseudonym of Satoshi Nakamoto. No one's ever found out who Satoshi Nakamoto is and whether it was a real person or a group of people or whatever. But he, they, she created Bitcoin and the rules around it and the algorithms required to mine it. And, you know, it's some very complicated and some very clever mathematics. But the point of it is a currency. There have been noises of one or two countries even thinking of adopting it as their own currency, but it doesn't always have the stability behind it. So would you want to put your pension fund in Bitcoin? You could be a very rich pensioner.
Well, I'd like a pension fund first.
Yeah, well, there is that. But you take my point, you know.
Yeah.
It depends what you want. So when people invest, they often have a range of investments, don't they? They often have, like, safe investments, and then a portion that they can afford to lose, they'll put into something risky. But, as I say, that's beyond my pay grade. But ultimately, it's an interesting idea, because in a sense it's purer, because it's not subject to being messed with by central banks, you know, where when an economy gets into trouble, they just print more money. You know, you can't do that, and that's kind of attractive. There's also one of the other things about it, I guess, to say, is that it's easier to transact Bitcoin transactions anonymously, and that can be a good thing. But it can also mean that a lot of drugs money and other illicit money is laundered in that way through Bitcoin. And it's quite interesting, you know. I mean, Tesla, you could buy a Tesla car with Bitcoins. You can pay quite a few bills with Bitcoins now, although I suggest it's still more of a novelty. I couldn't recommend that people go out and buy Bitcoins, because it is a risky activity.
Well, fantastic. Very interesting, as ever, Fevzi. Now, I've got lots of questions that we haven't been able to get to. So if anyone's desperate to get some advice, I don't suppose Fevzi will be doing it at this time of the morning, but
I'll be up for another 45 minutes.
Okay, well, you can tweet Fevzi and put your question. And also, I've got some interesting comments, so I'll read those out after the news. Fevzi, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk to you again. Cheers. Very soon.